Good morning. I want you to know what an honor it is for me to stand in your presence. How many of you have not heard me speak before? Raise your hand. We'll have fun. I grew up in Seattle. Bellevue Unity was the second Unity church I ever went to back in the late 70s. Let me give you a little of my background. Today we're going to talk about the mystical history of Unity. Now, I want you to understand, if I was talking to you one-on-one, the first thing I'd do is find out what books have you read. What trainings have you taken? What words and concepts are you familiar with as you explore this idea of being God in form? And then after I asked you those questions, we could do this whole thing this morning based on the words and concepts you're familiar with. Since I'm up here and I'm going to take about a half an hour, there's a good chance as I get on a roll this morning, I might say something a little different than you're used to. I might quote scripture a little different or tell a story a little different. And all I would ask is if we run into a place where there's a little difference, please look past it. Because I guarantee you my sole intention this morning is to remind each of us how absolutely magnificent and powerful we are right now. We got that? Good. Now, let me give you a little of my background, because there's a lot of people who haven't heard me. I got into this philosophy, Unity, what I call the practical application of the teachings of Jesus, was up when I was about 23. I hurt my back when I was working on the 747 plant up in Everett, Washington, when we were building that. I was going to college up there and was working one summer and hurt my back, had a spinal fusion. During surgery, my spine got infected with the E. coli bacteria. This was 40-some years ago. And E. coli is a bad bug, and it was even worse back then because there aren't any good antibiotics. So at Swedish Hospital, they did 5 surgeries to get rid of the infection, including the fusion. Every time they went, it was worse. Finally, my doctor, this orthopedic surgeon who happened to be over on Mercer Island, said, look, this is way out of my league. You need a lot more than one primary care physician, so I've referred your case to the University of Washington Medical Center. It's a big teaching hospital. He said, they got all the experts you need under one roof there. So I went in there. They did tests. For 2 weeks, they did tests. Every day, all day. They poked me in places I didn't even know I had places. Finally, the night before the 6th surgery on my spine, 6 doctors walked into my room. It was 8:15. They'd been in a meeting all afternoon. 6 doctors. Visiting professor from England, orthopedics, supposed to be the number 3 orthopedic surgeon in the world. The other professors didn't talk like that, but the interns and residents did. Chief of general surgery. The head of the Department of Infectious Disease, their 3 top residents, and this is what they said. I'll summarize it. This is what they said. This infection is no longer just in your spine. It's spread. It's throughout your pelvic area. It's throughout your abdomen. It's eating holes, because E. coli just eats things. It's eating holes in the lower end of your colon, so the germs are communicating back and forth, not like talking, but like traveling. And it's followed both of your sciatic nerves into your thighs. And if we don't stop it now, this will kill you. This has now become life-threatening. So tomorrow we're going to take you down to the operating theater, and the general surgeons are going to start from the front. They're going to start as low as it, because what he said was, with E. coli, there's not a good antibiotic. We need to just go in and cut out this infection. Wherever it is in your body, we're going to cut it out. So first, the general surgeons are going to start from the front. They're going to start as low as they can, go down here in your pelvic area, come up around your belly button. We're going to go up your sternum. We're going to open all that up. We're going to cut out all the infected tissue, separate your organs out of the way, and when we get down the spine, the orthopedic surgeons will chisel and scrape the infection out of your spine. When we're done with that, we're going to roll you over, and the orthopedic surgeons are going to start from the back. They're going to start as low as they can go down between your buttocks. They're going to come up mid-back. We're going to open all that up, cut out all the infected tissue, chisel and scrape the infection out of your spine. They went into a lot more detail than I'm giving you. When we're done with that, two teams of surgeons are going to start at your belt line, open up both your buttocks and follow your sciatic nerves into your thighs. When we're done with that, we're going to tip you up on the end and come in between the from the bottom. That one got my attention. When he got done, this guy from England sat down on a chair, pulled it up next to the bed, and reached out and took my hand. And that's when I knew I was in trouble. Because this guy was not a touchy-feely doctor. And he said, "Son, I know how radical this must seem, but we have to stop this infection now. When we're done with the surgery, we're pretty sure we can stop it from spreading anymore. We can also virtually guarantee you, you are going to lose the use of your left leg through nerve damage." And then he just looked at me. And I just looked at him. And he just looked at me. And finally, I figured it must be my turn to say something. And I heard come out of my own mouth, "That's okay. That's okay. If we've got to do that, let's just get it over with." But even as those words came out of my mouth, I thought, what has happened to me? What has happened that in just 1 year I would so willingly give up the use of my left leg? But I no sooner said that than he reached up with his other hand, clamped mine between his, and he said, "Son, we have to do this. If it's as bad as we think it is, the really bad news is there's a good chance you're going to lose some of the mobility of your right leg. You're probably going to lose the control of your bowels and your bladder, and there's a very good chance you're going to end up sexually impotent." I was 23. When they left, the resident who had been with me for the 2 weeks of tests sat on my bed and held me. He didn't say anything. He just held me. And this was 45 years ago. And finally, when I calmed down, he said, "Terry, we don't know what's going to happen. We've never seen anything like this. But what we do know is you cannot expect to come out of this hole." The name of my book is The Hell I Can't. I invite you this morning to get underneath the words I use. If I say something that's a little different, I invite you to get past it. Because when I talk to you about your absolute authority on this physical plane to create reality, it's not just because I read a book. When they went in the next morning, they opened up the pelvic area and they said, "Lord, and my colon was just perforated." They said there weren't any holes. It was just like a sieve. They pulled my bowels out and clipped them, sewed them to my tummy. It's called a colostomy. They said, "You're going to go to the bathroom in a plastic bag for the rest of your life." I had 27 major surgical procedures on my spine and abdomen at the University of Washington Hospital. 27 with a general anesthetic. I have letters from some of the finest doctors in the world to the insurance company saying that what I had was not curable, that I would be left with significant permanent disability, that my lower end of my colon would never be able to heal. I'm going to be 69 this year. I don't have a bad back. I'm not recovering from a bad back. I haven't learned to live within my human limitations. And I took the prayer they gave me that said I needed to accept the things I could not change, and I put it in the trash, and I put a new one up that said all things are possible if only I believe. Of course, when I did that, people looked me right in the eye and said, "Who do you think you are?" I knew better than to tell them I thought I was the physical embodiment of God, because there was a psychiatrist involved in my case. And you say that at the University of Washington Hospital 45 years ago, and they give you a coat that ties in the back. When I talk to you this morning about your divine authority, I know who you are. Because I had an opportunity to find out who I was. But this morning is not just about using these principles to heal, which you certainly can. Like in the meditation, you can use these principles to create new relationships. You can use these principles to create new abundance. All things are possible if only you believe. But it's challenging today. You know, one of the things I love about unity is we acknowledge there are many paths to God. Many different paths to God. What we forget sometimes is these different paths are just that. They are different. Going with the flow is not the same as changing the course of the river. Giving up your attachments to the outcome is not the same as being absolutely committed to creating what you want. It can be challenging. And I invite you this morning to get underneath the words I use. Because of my illness, if you will, because of facing these, what they said was, they said the chances of you getting well are 1,000,000 to 1. You would need a miracle. Because of that idea that when I went to the spiritual principles, when I went to study these various concepts that were out there about who we were and our power on this physical plane, I always tended to gravitate to the ones that, the ideas that spoke to our power. The ideas and concepts that spoke to our authority. I mean, Jesus said all things are possible if you believe there, but what did he mean by that? When he said that whatever you ask for in prayer, believing you shall have it, what did he mean by that? When he spoke that the faith of a mustard seed could move a mountain, did he really mean that I had the ability to create faith? And that if I created enough faith, I could create the miracle I needed? Is that what he was really saying? And so I always sort of paid attention to the spiritual teachings that spoke to the abilities that we have, like Jesus did when he said, "Know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." What was the truth he was talking about? And what was the freedom he was addressing? As I go back in my study of all these great teachings, and this is sort of a condensed version of the mystical heritage of unity. The oldest living religion on the planet is the Hindu one. I mean, that's my opinion. If you've got an older one, then please look past that little statement. But the oldest living one that I could find was the Hindu faith. Now, when I started studying and playing with the Hindu philosophy, what it seemed to me that it was so confusing. They had 1,000 gods. They had a god for everything. But as I continued to study and read, what I found was one of the foundations for the Hindu faith is they believe everybody's different. And so as they approach their teachings about this divine presence in the universe, they made it specific based on your differences. If you were a farmer, they created a god that was just for farmers. And if you pray to this god and get this image, this little statue that was the god that was for farmers, then you could pray to God about your priorities, which was growing a crop. If you were a woman and you were trying to have children, they had a god that was just for fertility, for women. And they had a little statue so that you could... So when you went to explore God, the divinity, you could explore God based on your priorities. Having children, growing a farm, plants, having relationships. There's a god for relationships. But as I studied, I began to understand that these various gods were really just outpicturing of the one God. And so it wasn't as confusing as I thought it was. And then as I studied the Hindu faith, you start to move into the mystical teachings within Hinduism. And there's a wonderful book called The Magic and Mysticism of India. And the author says this. He's working with several various, you know, big shots within the Hindu faith, very masters. And it says this. In the Hindu teachings, it is held that there exists a universal mental principle, which is known as creative mind. That's the translation. Creative mind. And the essence and elementary character of this creative mind is something like the blending or the combination of one's imagination and one's personal will. And that each individual on the planet is possessed a portion of this creative mind. And that each individual is able to use this creative mind based on their priorities. And then it goes down and it says, in other words, the Hindu teachings hold that the mind, when advanced enough, has the power of materializing physical creation directly itself without the need for physical activity. So at the top end of the Hindu teachings, in the mystical side, they teach that you have a creative mind, and if you take charge of your creative mind, you can do miracles. Pick up your bed and walk. Be cleansed. Take a few loaves and fishes and feed 5,000. And what it says in the Hindu teachings is that the achievement and being able to use one's creative mind to be able to demonstrate these apparent miracles is part of our mental inheritance and can be used when we evolve sufficiently to make use of these godlike abilities. So within the Hindu teachings, if you move through them and move up into the mystical side, what they essentially say is you have inside of you, you have an aspect of you they call creative mind. And if you take charge of your creative mind, your consciousness, you can move it to a level where you can do even greater works than the masters. That all things are possible if only you believe. So that's the Hindus. Then as I move through the sort of the lineage, the next living religion that really has the pieces that move on into what I call unity is the Jewish faith. That was started by Abraham or Abram, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And he grew up in a time when he lived in a city where there were all kinds of gods. Not like the Hindus where they had these different gods and it moved up to one, but I mean there were all these different gods. And one day he decided, no, there's not all these different gods. There's only one God, monotheistic, one God that does everything. And out of his teachings evolved the Jewish faith and the Jewish traditions. Early on in the Jewish traditions, it is said that they came up with the idea that we are made in the image and likeness of God. You're aware of that, yes? Nod your head. Good. In the 13th century, a renowned Hebrew scholar known as Moses ben Maimon opens his book, which is called The Guide for the Perplexed. So no, back even in the 13th century, there was, what do we do with all this stuff? And so he wrote a book called The Guide for the Perplexed. Now he's a Hebrew scholar, not a Jewish scholar. He's a scholar of the language. And what he says in his book is that the idea of made in the image and likeness of God, that the original founders of the Jewish faith thought that meant a physical likeness. And he says, let us make man in our image signifies not a physical likeness, but an intellectual likeness. So in the Jewish faith, what they say is that there is part of you that has an intellectual likeness to the divine. Which is similar to the Hindus say the universe is made up of creative mind and you have a creative mind. Then you move into the, I know this is a little dry, but it gets to a really great point. Then you move into the mystical teachings of Hinduism, or I mean the Jewish faith, and that's usually embodied in the Kabbalah. In the Kabbalah, if you read the Kabbalah, the whole purpose of the mystical side of Judaism based on the Kabbalah was to heal the apparent separation between humankind when they left from being pure spirit with God and they came to form. And so within the Jewish faith, they have that separation thing, the fall from grace. They don't mean that, not call it that within Judaism like we did in Christianity, but there's a fall from grace. And the whole mystical side of Judaism is how to use spiritual principles to heal that spiritual separation. And it's called kovana, mystical intention in prayer. It's what we in unity would call affirmative prayer. And the whole purpose of you learning how to take charge of your mind was to use mystical intention in prayer to heal this apparent spiritual separation. and along comes a guy named Isaac Luria. And he's credited as being one of the three most influential teachers in the history of the Kabbalah. And in the book, Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism, the author says this: "But Luria took the whole school of thought in classical Kabbalism and merely developed it further. And to him, prayer was more than just the possibility of healing spiritual needs. He knew that you could use prayer to facilitate solving human needs. And Luria's doctrine of mystical intention in prayer stands directly on the borderline between traditional mysticism, you can only use it for this stuff, and magic." And when they use the word magic, they're not talking sleight of hand. Thousands of years ago, the idea of magic was when you use the power of the mind to heal human needs. Pick up your bed and walk, be cleansed, feeding the masses, that was referred to as magic. If you were using these principles on your spiritual needs, that was called, the mystical stuff. And so Luria brought in the idea that you could use these principles on your human needs. You could make your human dreams come true. Now, when he brought that in, there was all kinds of, oh, no, you can only use it for this stuff. You can't use it for that. And plus, you couldn't even get into study the Kabbalah unless you were a male. You had to have jumped through all the hoops. You had to have all the right, credentials. In the Hindu stuff, you couldn't get to study the mystical stuff unless you were born in the right caste system, unless you were. And so it was only a select group that were looking at it. But when Luria came along and said, you can use these principles on your human needs, there was this big brouhaha. Oh, no, you can't. There's a power, but you can only use it for the highest and best good of everybody. You can't use it just to get what you want. There's a power, but you can. And do you notice that there are those kinds of rules today? Have you noticed that? There's still, where can you use it? Well, you can't use it for this, you can't use it for this, you can't use it for this. It's confusing. When I was in the hospital for the 17th surgery, they sent me to see a psychiatrist, and I said, I'm reading these books. He said, you're going to live in a wheelchair forever. You're going to have a colostomy the rest of your life. Come work with me. I can assist you to face that reality with dignity. And I said, I don't want to believe like you. I'm reading these books. And these books, they say there's a part of me that's not sick. These books say there's a part of me that's not afraid. And what these books say, if I can get in touch with that part of me, if I can own that's who I am, that part of me that's not sick and afraid, from there, I can learn how to create reality rather than face reality. And he said, Terry, that's your ego talking. And you know you can't use these principles just for your own ego self-gratification. You all know that. But Luria said, no, you can use this stuff on anything. And then shortly after Luria, this is about 2,500 years ago, up came what we call today the ancient mystery schools. The Essenes, the Druids, the Magi from Persia, the school of Isis for women in Egypt. And like today, these different mystery schools taught different things. The Essenes taught a lot about meditation and ritual. The Magi taught how to use mind to create form. And that's why they were called Magi. That's where the word magic comes from. And the term, the way they used to create, take charge of your mind to create form, the discipline they used was their imagination. Take imagine, the word imagine, and break it down. It's spelled I-M-A, genie. Now, I'm not saying that all of that stuff is absolutely true. What I'm saying is that if you go back and study the mystical history of unity, there is this silver thread that runs through these great teachings that talk about the power of the individual, that speak to the idea that all things are possible if only you believe, that the entire universe awaits your intention, that it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom, on and on and on. These ideas are in there. But it was secret. You couldn't even study this stuff unless you were a male and of the right system, unless the school of Isis for women. And it's said in these mystical writings that all the leaders of these various organizations were really one. That the leader of the top person of the Essenes was a brother with the top person of the Magi. That was a, you know, maybe not blood brother, but that they were all together. They knew each other. They knew these teachings were the salvation of humanity. And about 2,500 years ago, it's spoken about that these great masters got together and said, it's time we take these teachings and take off the veil of secrecy and take these teachings to the world. And so what is spoken about is that a great master was called forth to come to take these great teachings to the world. And there's many references to this great master who came 2,000 years ago, whose name was Jesus. I'm not saying this is absolutely the way it is, and you can prove this and that. I'm talking about if you go study this stuff from the furthest back, thousands and thousands of years ago, there is a silver thread that runs through the mystical teachings that talk about how magnificent you are and how powerful you are. And that Jesus came again. And in the original Greek writings of the New Testament, because it was written, I think, first in Greek, the three guys that come to visit Jesus at his birth are not called the three wise men, not in the original Greek. In the original Greek, they're called the masters of Magi. And the mystical symbolism of the masters of Magi coming from three different places to celebrate Jesus' birth was that that was symbolically the acknowledgement that finally these secret teachings are available to the world. What Jesus brought to the human race is different than a lot of other great teachers. Certainly there's the same compassion, loving one another, but what Jesus brought to the human race was the idea of your divine authority on this physical plane. When he said, all things are possible if only you believe they are, he wasn't talking in sub-abstract. When he said, those who believe on me, and when you go study what that means, it says those who have the same belief system as I do can do even greater works than I can do. That's what unity offers you. Unity is the practical application of the teachings of Jesus that through thousands of years have finally come to the forefront and said, the road to your enlightenment, the road to your understanding, your union with the divine, is through you making your dreams come true. Christianity is not about giving up your attachments to the outcome. Christianity is about creating the outcome you want. And through doing that, you get an experience of who you are. It's hard to explain. It's hard to talk about. You've experienced it at times, and then you go to write it down in words, and it's like, well, that's sort of it, but not quite. It works kind of like this. When you use these principles, this is what Jesus said, faith without works is dead. What he was talking about is you need to use this. You need to prove this. Use these principles on something that's important to you. And when it happens, you get an experience of self, an experience of life that's bigger than the thing you just created. Remember the first time you created a parking place? It can be like that. You're on your way somewhere, you think, and you go do whatever you do because you have a friend that can always do it. And so you just tried it on the way there and you pull up and finally you're waiting at the light and, you know, it doesn't look like there's any parking places and the light turns green. You start across and somebody runs to their car and you wait and they pull out and you pull in and part of you goes, ha, this stuff works. That's what Christianity is about. Use these principles on something that's important to you, and it could be as simple as creating a parking place. Or on the way home from a church service, you've been talking about, Nancy has been talking about we're all one, and you're on your way home, you're thinking, I've lost track of this person. I'd like to talk to him. So you send him, you do whatever you do. You do your prayer work. You do the way you do it. And you send them a message that says, I need you to call me. I've lost your number. You know what I'm getting at. And 2 days later, you're walking around the house and the phone rings. You pick it up and you go, hello. And as soon as the voice on the other side of the line says hello back, you realize it's your friend. And part of you goes, this stuff works. That's what Jesus brought to the human race. These principles are not about do this stuff and when you die you go to a better place. These principles are about use this stuff and this becomes heaven on earth. Your priorities, your desires. Use these principles on what's important to you, and when it happens you get an experience of life that's bigger than the thing you just created. And the next desire comes up. The next want. Use the principles on that, and when that happens you get that experience. Wow, it happened again! Next want comes up. Use the principles on that. About the third time in a row that you do it and it happens, there's a shift in the mind. And the shift is sort of like, I'm on a hot streak. Or all things are working together for good in my life. And I don't mean that as an affirmation when your life's going down the toilet. I mean you get an experience. Oh, everything's working. That's where many people stop using the tools. I've known Nancy and Bill for a long time. What they call you to do here and in their classes and on Bill's Wednesday night class is encourage you to use the tools even when you're on a hot streak. Use the tools even when things are going well and you move into the state that I call the state of grace. It can be difficult to use these tools in the state of grace because a lot of people said, well, you can't use these for your own ego-centered priorities. You know, your need to be whole is just ego-driven. You know, after all, you're the son of a dead war hero. You think you won't be a whole man if you can't stand on your own two legs. You're right. It can be challenging to step up and own these on your priorities because you've been taught that other people know better for you than you do. But what this church is about is you making your dreams come true. And when you continue to use them, even as you move through this, what I call the state of grace, there will come a time when you look in the mirror. For me, it's looking in a mirror and seeing a body that's whole. I don't have a colostomy anymore. I don't have any pain. I don't have any residual effect. To be able to look in the mirror and ask the question, who must I be? Who must I be to have been able to create this magnificent, healthy body? And the answer is my beloved daughter, in whom I'm well pleased. My beloved son. What Jesus brought to the human race is you can use these principles to make your dreams come true. And when you make your dreams come true, what you will get is you're an experience of what it's like to be one with God. Jesus said, know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. He didn't say, forgive enough, and when you forgive enough, you'll be free. He said, know something. Just know something. And that knowing is that you are God expressing uniquely as woman. God expressing uniquely as man. And from that truth, you are free. And what are you free from? The lie of human limitations. You and I stand on a threshold where very few people have been in the history of the world. And that threshold is to really own the truth that we are God expressing as woman, God expressing as man. And from that truth, we have the right and the authority to make our dreams come true. What this church offers you is your road to freedom. And I personally think that to really own this stuff, it's more than just coming to church on Sunday. We were talking earlier about when we just went to church. And then when you came back, you just said, I'm going to get involved. And you were secretary. Now you're president. And it's through that involvement. It's through going to, you know, you've taken time to go to this conference out there. And you never been to one before. And then you went there and went, and you should have been out there watching his face, watching his body as he's talking about what he's getting by being involved as your president. In July, you had a discovery day not too long ago where you filled out priorities for the church. In July, it's going to be presented. Your board has put all of those results together and said, this is what you as a congregation have said that your priorities are, and we're putting them together as an opportunity for you. And they're going to be asking you, where would you like to get involved? As an outsider, with no investment, specifically in this marvelous center, I would tell you from the bottom of my heart, get involved. Because mastering these principles is more than just coming to church on Sunday. Get involved. You want to feel like you're part of this church? Be a greeter. You get to love everybody on their way in. You know, come early and do the hospitality program. I'm sure they got a grounds program. Get involved and make this philosophy part of the fabric of your existence. And what you will find is your own magnificence and your own power. It's an honor for me to stand in your presence. I celebrate who you are. I celebrate what you have. And I celebrate this marvelous teaching center called Unity of Bellevue. Way to go. God bless.